This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. For his monthly open clinic on mental health, we have with us Paul Jamunathan, consultant clinical psychologist. And this is, of course, the monthly show where Paul joins us to address any of your concerns that you have regarding your mental, emotional, or psychosocial issues, anything that you're going through in your personal life, family life, relationships, things to do with your workplace as well. Anything that you feel you need some advice, you need some guidance, Paul is here to provide that. So our lines are open for you, 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us, 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon, Paul. How are you today?
Good afternoon. How am I doing today? As good as possible.
Yes, it's as good as possible. And we haven't seen you since Chinese New Year started, so
Sama. Yes, I hope it was a good one for you.
It has been a good one, and we haven't been able to stop eating. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
We'll see in a couple of weeks.
I'm already feeling it.
No, the fun times together while eating or while playing, I think that's really what counts.
I don't know, love. With Malaysians, I feel like the food comes first.
Yeah, true. But, you know, the old way, the food was such a central thing, and it still is in a different way now. Mm-hmm. But the communal preparation of food, the family preparation, even the neighbours getting involved, wow, that's for me a very nice thing.
That's true. But I feel we are losing that somewhat these days as families. Families get smaller for one.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily celebrate with all our extended relatives.
Yeah.
A lot of people are going out to eat. So we lose that aspect of that communal preparation.
I saw that in a big way. I saw that this time round, when we went out to buy food, and on Christmas Eve, on Chinese New Year Eve itself, and on Chinese New Year Day, I saw a lot of Chinese families who were eating out.
Yes.
I'm not saying they're right or wrong, but it has changed in such a way.
Yep.
I know another family where the New Year's Eve dinner was... regularly, there were so many motorbikes passing my house, and they were all grabbed motorbikes.
Right.
So they were bringing in food. And they were older people, no doubt, but the cooking together, or the prep together, but the family was there.
Mm.
So I suppose the time spent and the quality time and the presence, I think those are the things that fundamentally reduce it to what's most important.
Yes, as long as you're spending that time together. Apart from it being Chinese New Year this period, it was also World Cancer Day yesterday.
That's right.
And, we on BFM, we had a whole day dedicated to programming related to different aspects of living with cancer.
Right.
Not just the health aspects. I think it's important to look at in terms of how it affects a person's life in all the different parts of your living with the disease. And because cancer today, for the most part, is a chronic condition.
Mm-hmm.
It's highly treatable. You live with it for a very long time, and how it affects you. So one important aspect, I thought that we could discuss it a little bit today as we wait for callers to call in for the open clinic, is maybe we could look a little bit at the mental health aspect of living with cancer.
Right.
First of all, do we talk about that enough?
No, we don't talk about it. We don't talk about anything to do with death or the threat to life or anything that jeopardizes or kind of sabotages your expectation of what life should be.
Mm.
And especially, of course, death. No one talks about it enough when it actually is part of the human lifespan. We don't talk about it enough. And I think the more we talk about not so much death as in the departing of the physical being, but the process of dying and how one dies. It's not like a tragic car accident, instantaneously unexpected, but from a disease where the opportunity to deal with death, the opportunity to deal with the termination and the ending phase of life presents itself for discussion, exploration, and for qualification, as in making it quality to be understood and shared.
Mm.
It's a transition. It's just another transition point in the life of not the person who's departing, but in the lives of those who are left behind.
I mean, when we talk about cancer or really any other disease, the approach is diagnosis. And then let's talk about how you can treat it or manage it.
Sure.
And you're right. We want to delay the talk of death as much as possible. Yeah. And so along with that, we don't address the emotional journey of coming to terms that, you know, death, like you said, how do you deal with the possibility of death?
Yeah. And there's so many things associated with the issue of death. It's not just the diagnosis of cancer or any other terminal illness, but the fear factor that presents itself before that, even with the discovery of, say, a node or a lump or even a rash or anything for that matter that indicates there could be something serious behind it, itself invokes and starts you thinking in terms of, hello, this is so serious. Mm-hmm. It could mean something really bad. And therefore, when you join the dots, you see death at the end of it. That itself delays you. So if you want to use death as a metaphor, that's when it occurs the first time around. Mm-hmm. So you die several times over when you're talking about a disease like this, like cancer. Do I have cancer? You're already dead that once. Mm-hmm. You die a different kind of death. Then you go for your tests. Then you see the lab results. Then you talk to the doctor about it. The first thing, the thing that's prevailing in your mind all the time is, will I survive this? Will I live through it? How dangerous is it? So if you're talking about death in that sense, you die many times over. Yeah.
Mm. I mean, cancer, of course, is in a way the most extreme of examples.
Yeah.
But we, you know, a lot of other chronic conditions are also prevalent in Malaysia today. Heart disease, diabetes, and all life-changing.
The non-communicable ones, yeah.
Yes, all life-changing diseases that could quite significantly change your quality of life, affect your survival as well. Mm. Is the way that we look at those diseases the same, that fear of death?
There's a lot of medical history associated with that. There's not enough recent psychological history behind that. But cultural history is what determines a lot of our responses. People's fear and understanding of these diseases. And of course, because of the cultural aspect of things, we have this epidemiology aspect of things where it occurs in different intensities in different parts of the world, given the distribution, and that determines how people respond to it. So if you're talking about, for instance, physical ailments or physical disabilities such as war-torn zones and broken bones and shattered bones and amputations, people who grow up in war-torn zones, for instance, deal with that differently from a Malaysian setting where we don't have these kinds of wars. So our perception and our cultural response will be different. Now, the responses to things like diabetes or Ebola or now for instance, coronavirus, we are responding to it. Our cultural and psychological response to it is different from people in China itself. Now, these things, the cultural perspective plays a big role, and that cultural perspective extends into the perception, the understanding, and the acceptance of death. Because we die with our cultures. We die with these things that are inbred in us from a young age, like after you die, where you're going. Who is that an entity that's going to be looking after you? Are you going up or down or sideways? You know, that kind of things. It's culturally dependent. Briefly, that one word I'd like to respond with really is the education of these diseases. And now it's becoming more globalized and people can understand it more. The opportunity to understand these diseases and its process is far better now to be taught at a younger age, to be exposed younger, but still this cultural fears pervade and distort a lot of things. You know, grandma died of cancer and that big C word. Rather than say, let's talk about cancer. where it comes from, how to prevent it, things like that.
Mm.
Yeah, so the education bit is crucial. It's good to have things like the World Cancer Day, but it should be every day.
Yeah. I mean, information comes to us now very much online.
Yeah.
An abundance, a plethora of information out there. But we also see the other side of that, where misinformation then spreads.
Yeah.
And how much of... you know, for people's tendency to be misinformed or to believe in fake news or unverified sources, how much of that is tied to an emotional response?
The first thing to understand is this phrase called confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
Wanting to prove what you think is right is right.
Yeah. And so you look for...
You look for things to support that bias.
Mm-hmm.
And... how does it start? It starts with things like primacy. The first bit of information you get, who put it there, who sowed that seed, how relevant or official is this person who put that notion in your mind?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go looking for things to support it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not looking at it critically to evaluate it. Now, as you say, there's so much information out there. Unfortunately, we fall into this confirmation bias tendency and we ignore or don't see the other side of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
What's important is, yes, we cannot stop anyone from reading both the rights and the wrongs of information. However, using that resource, we should also look at the expert resource, looking at the right sites to understand the seesaw effect of knowledge and what you can and cannot do. But that's what's missing. As psychologists go, you know, let me give you this example. There are a whole bunch of people who use psychometric tests, you know, and they're sold by the millions.
Yes.
And people love numbers and all these questions, et cetera, et cetera. But crazy guys like me, yes, we also use psychometric tests who I call myself crazy because I don't belong to that standardized norm where we define ourselves by the questions and the numbers and the responses you get. We read between the lines of those questions because there are no two questions that define you.
Mm-hmm.
No space can define you.
Mm-hmm.
But so when you understand issues of knowledge from the computers and from the net, what you should be looking at or being taught to do is to read between the lines and, better still, ask questions about what you don't see and what you really want to know about. That's where the experts come in.
Mm.
And fortunately, we've got experts like Dr. Mello and other, in other fields as well, who come across and share it. There are not enough people who, you know, fantastic brains we have, but we don't have enough opportunity or the marketability or the desire to for this information to come across daily as part of your diet.
Mm. I also feel that even the idea of who is an expert that we can trust, and it comes, there's a lot of mistrust of the establishment of authorities.
Yeah, loads of charlatans as well.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of
waiting,
clowns.
Yeah, charlatans waiting to...
That's right.
Yeah.
And different motives. I suppose the way to go about this is to look at the kind of organization, the kind of credibility they have, the track record of people. And even when you're looking up the blog sites, you know, you've got some good blog sites, you've got some rubbish sites as well. But it's who writes it, doing the research behind it first. And just because you say this is a recent paper from a journal, it doesn't mean much unless you know what journal stands for, what the people stand for. And, you know, even the experts can be wrong at times.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why they're an expert is not because they're right most of the time, but it's because of the process of decision making, the process of critical thinking, the process. There's so many things that go with being right or correct in your information distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people should learn to be able to appreciate the distinction of that kind of expertise.
Mm.
It's not the letters behind your name. It's not the university you come from. It's the hows and the whys and your value system.
Mm. Yeah. And so with a diagnosis of a chronic disease especially, it's in talking to your doctor, your expert, and for that doctor to explain that process to you, to take you on that process together.
Yes, the trust factor should be there. One thing is the patient, let's call him the client. They're not always sick people. Mm-hmm. But the client who requires this information should first of all understand that they have a right to all information. Mm-hmm. And they should seek out as much information as possible. And of course, one of the definitions of being a good expert educator is the clinician or the expert who's ready to educate his client. And the ability and the security to say, you're not questioning my expertise. You're asking me for more information. Mm. And that's the kind of doctor or expert I would like. Mm. And take you through this journey. I'm one of those guys who says, listen, this is my opinion, but Shaobik, I'd like you to get a second opinion too. Mm. And most of the experts I work with, I'd say 100%, are people who are secure enough to say, please get a second opinion. Come back if you want to. Mm. But get as much information as possible, but at least come back to discuss it. Mm. And that discussion, that between the line space, is crucial.
And that's going to do a lot to alleviate the emotional distress.
Definitely. Yeah. And of course, the planning, and not just the emotional distress, but you'd be surprised at the amount of literature we have to evidence to suggest that the more you know and the more you participate in this whole process, even the intervention and the outcome is far more positive. Mm. The healing process, mm. The recovery process, the rehabilitation process, mm-hmm. the relationship between the doctor and you, the relationship between you and your family or your support system for that matter, mm-hmm. everything has a positive effect linked strongly with information, education, participation, your involvement. Mm.
We have Paul Jambunathan, consultant clinical psychologist, in the studio with us. It's our monthly open clinic on mental health issues. So call us 03-7733-2900 if you have any questions for Paul. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've been talking about sort of the mental health issues around living with cancer and a chronic condition, but really, if you have any other issues you'd like Paul to address, contact us. We already have a few messages that I'll get back to after our quick break right here on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Shao-Yi, and in the studio with me, consultant clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan, here for his monthly mental health clinic. If you have questions, call us. Our lines are open. 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Any issues, any mental, emotional, psychosocial issues that you'd like Paul to help you address? We have a question/comment from Jason on WhatsApp, asking why is palliative care referral not widely discussed in Malaysia? And he refers to Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, which states that those who saw a palliative care specialist earlier experienced less suffering at the end of their lives and they lived 25% longer, or rather, the survival time. And of course, this is not a show with an oncologist or a palliative care specialist, but I think the idea links to what you were talking about, discussing what the disease means in terms of the end of life.
Right. Mm. But it's interesting. I mean, we don't have many palliative care specialists. The branch has developed, I would say, relatively recently in Malaysia. Of course, we needed oncologists big time and to treat the disease and all of that. We need that first. Mm-hmm. But one of the strongest supportive systems we have, which is really, 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 I say this and I've got international experience, is the Malaysian hospice care is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's by any standard, we are very, very, very good about how we deal with it, the establishment. So those of you who are interested in Malaysian hospice, please look them up, get involved with them. We've got very, very high standards, super stuff. Mm. Palliative care. Interestingly, I'm involved in a lot of palliative care and I helped set up a palliative care unit in one of the hospitals. Mm-hmm. And we now have doctors who are going out and getting trained in it. And my area is not just the medical management within palliative care, but the psychosocial aspect, the whole psychological issue behind it. Why isn't it as common? Because of the cultural taboos of death and people's readiness to talk about it. But it's coming in, and we have The word, the phrase is a terrible phrase, angels of death. Mm. But we have these lovely doctors, specialists. You don't have to be a doctor to be involved in palliative care in certain aspects of it. But we have nurses who are highly trained in it. We have doctors who elect and opt for that kind of care. We have doctors who incorporate that care into the general medical care as well. We have GPs who treat the families who have a client mm-hmm. who is suffering from cancer terminally. Mm-hmm. And so palliative care is not a bad thing. We need to understand it as usual. Maybe one day we will have this topic on death and dying in a very nice, positive way where this idea of palliative care comes in. It's relatively new. It's a cultural taboo. People are afraid of this word, meaning you might be unwittingly inviting the knock on the door if you talk about it too often. Mm-hmm. But understanding how one's life, both physiologically, organically, how that peters away, and how one psychologically dies, how one dies in terms of a community is crucial. Mm. Attached to that, Shawik, are other things that are far more salient. Things like your belief systems, things like the family or the group's process of how they process it, the grieving system, the metaphors involved in dying, the preparation and the pre-belief issues that go into the process. A lot of things come into play, but you know what? The puzzle fits very nicely when you begin to understand each piece of the puzzle. It's just that we look at the big picture and say, are you die, death, expensive la, don't tell anybody la, things like that. All need to be respected. But understanding the issue of palliative care, which is working towards the last physical presence phase of life, is what we need to understand.
Yeah, in the previous shows that we've done on health and living with palliative care specialists, such as from Hospice Malaysia.
All right, great.
There's always a lot of emphasis. Also, palliative care is not just about end of life or terminal care. It's about improving quality of life for
a person. Very importantly. Yeah. Improving quality of life.
While you're living with the
That's
disease.
That's right. Yeah. While you're living with the disease. And you're right with your stats and your report about people have prolonged, not just in terms of hours and days, but they've prolonged their quality. So you might still pass on during the time frame or even at a shorter period. But the amount of joy factor or the meaningful factor, the changes you've made in your life or the thought presence and your spirituality, your connections, mm-hmm. they could be a much higher quality because of this facilitation of palliative care.
That's right. This is our open health clinic with Paul Jambunathan, consultant clinical psychologist. So call us 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Paul, we have a question here about, I think this was reported very recently within this week in the news, if I'm not mistaken, a person with a disability who was jailed for 6 months for attempting suicide. And our law minister actually in the beginning of the year had already said that the government will be looking at decriminalizing suicide attempts. And he said there must be an alternative for mental health, an alternative mechanism to deal with the mental health aspects of suicide.
Right.
So Hafiz is wondering, what would that alternative mechanism look like?
Wow. Great. This fantastic question, as one would always respond with. We need to understand suicide first. We really need to understand suicide. It's not just in a person taking their own life. Suicide is a far more complex thing and yet another topic that we need to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Yet another phenomenon that's presented in dramas, in fun, in jest, in comic books, in various cultural movies and in so many forms. Suicide is talked about so often and presented so often, it gives you more opportunity for it to be misunderstood,
mm-hmm.
for the process to be misunderstood. It's too reduced for young people to understand. And so we're not exploring this idea of suicide
mm-hmm.
and why and how it happens. So how the mechanism should begin with the whole understanding of suicide, the sociology of it, the whole anthropological history behind it and why it matters differently in different cultures, in the animal kingdom as well. So all of this is part of life and death in different forms. It's a death in a different form. If the issue is about decriminalizing suicide, then one of the things everybody is interested in is the mind safe? Is the mind sane enough to make a decision of that nature? And there are many things of like religion and culture that suggest otherwise. So the question here now is it a crime to think about it or not? We're not going to go into that today, but the process should involve the idea of what and why and what happens to the person who gets to that stage of considering that as an option. The build-up to that stage. Now, it is quite clear to the trained eye. It is quite clear to the person who is suffering from it. It is the information transfer and the communication process between them and society, the immediate society, the primary and secondary environment. That relationship is not clear. If it is an unwanted, undesired outcome, this thing of suicide, then that process that builds up to it needs to be understood far more than it is being understood now. The indicators, the risk factors behind that, they need to be understood, because the consequence and the outcome is the taking of one's own life. So for it to be decriminalized, it's not just about passing a bill. It's not about just saying right or wrong and it's okay. I think because of the misunderstanding of suicide as a phenomenon, I think that needs to be looked at in a very, very, very carefully.
But from the perspective of a mental health care provider for yourself, why is it important to also have the to also relook the legal framework? Why is it important to decriminalize suicide?
Well, I can give you one point of view. This is not my only point of view, because it has to involve a serious discussion, psychological and very philosophical. But I'll give you one point of view. One of the things we can say for a very large, to a large extent of certainty, is that for someone to consider suicide as an option, they have got a problem that they are unable to deal with, and they have issues to deal with, and they've reached a point of helplessness and hopelessness. Why one gets to that stage? What other options have not occurred to this person? What are they doing during this phase? How long this helplessness and hopelessness has lasted? The consequence, many of us have felt helpless and hopeless at many stages in our lives, but it hasn't lasted that long enough for us to say, I've had enough. That for me is a greater consideration than the act of suicide itself. The process by which one lives through or gets into this one track, no U-turn kind of track of helplessness and hopelessness. So that's more important.
And, you know, as always, we encourage anyone who needs to talk to somebody. If you are feeling these feelings of hopelessness and helplessness, you need some emotional support, some anonymous emotional support.
Yeah.
We always encourage you to call Befrienders.
Yes.
At 03-795-68145. And it helps just to have somebody to talk to.
Now, adding to that is talk to anyone. Not anyone. Neither should we be talking to everyone. But find someone to talk to. It's lovely to talk to the trained ear. And it's easier to talk to an anonymous trained ear like the Befrienders. They're a fantastic organization. They need volunteers. Let me pitch in for them as well.
That's right.
Please, for those of you who you don't need to be problemless to become a Befriender. In fact, you know, if you have dealt with problems in your life, that's a good thing too. But try and understand the Befrienders. But the point I'm making here is talk to someone. The kind of person you should talk to are people who are responsible, responsive. They'll get back to you. They'll talk to you. People who have some element of wisdom, and people who can think a little clearly. Now, they don't have to think like you think, but you are sharing some issue that you have. So learn to share, voice out. Try. That's the best thing you to do.
Okay. We have a question on WhatsApp. Is it true that doing good work like helping the less fortunate might help a cancer patient be in a better frame of mind and therefore be advantageous to that person's health. And, you know, if such activities are beneficial to the individual, how can we convince them to take up these activities?
Okay. Charitable, or rather altruistic behaviour, selfless behaviour, caring for the less fortunate, or anyone for that matter, that's a good thing in general, full stop. Okay, that should be part of everybody's New Year resolution. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to help at least one person all year round. Now, yes, it's a very good thing. It is part of positive psychology. It is part of the prescription of adding to one's quality of life. It's part of the prescription of learning compassion. And it's supposed to be good for you and your spirit and your soul. Okay, that goes without saying. Whether it's good for a cancer patient, well, the answer is yes. It's also good for a diabetic patient. It's also good for a person with a fracture. It's not because you are learning to appreciate what you have and that your cancer is any lesser than someone who is hungry by the street side. It's not that. The issue is altruism in itself is a good thing. As a cancer patient, if you're involved in altruism, I say yay for you because you're involved in another activity. You're involved in something else besides your pain, and it doesn't substitute your pain, but it gives your existence meaning as well. So your existence is not defined only by your cancer and the dis-ease and the pain or the pain it brings other people, but your existence is also defined by the fact of I'm surviving cancer, living with it, but I'm also involved in other aspects that define who and what I am. So yes, in that sense, please get involved in sport or altruistic behaviour by all means.
And we have consultant clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan in the studio for his monthly mental health clinic. This is a show where you can call in and Paul will try to help you address any of your mental, emotional, psychosocial issues that you're dealing with in your life. Call us 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back. We'll be right back after a quick break and the market update right here on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back. It's Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik, as well as consultant clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan in here for his monthly mental health clinic. So call us 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio if you have any questions for Paul. We have one on WhatsApp. He's asking, he or she, sorry, I can't tell, but his mother is 90 odd years old, and she tends to visualize that her late husband is coming to take her away to his place, and she will even get ready with her luggage and wait for him. So he wants to know how to help his mother.
Thank you for that question. What love. What she's really missing, this man, her husband.
Yes.
So that's an immense amount of connection and relationship behind this.
Yes.
Such an wonderful thing to see, to experience.
But difficult for the family members.
Yes. I'm looking at the fact that she's missing him so much. That's fantastic. Now, the important thing to understand here is I want to use the common phrase, crazy, mad, lunatic, okay? None of these things apply. Please don't think that your mom or anyone who's suffering and going through this kind of phase has lost it. They have not. Okay. Now, how long they stay in this process and the other things they do, not just getting the bags ready and wanting to join the person who's passed away. So many other things, behavioral and emotional things, need to be considered by the family, the primary caregivers, and the experts before coming to an intervention of sorts. But just talking about the fact that she'll get ready with her luggage and waiting for him, she's still missing the man. She's still not come to terms with maybe the death in by our definition. By our definition, what she's doing is extraordinary, and it is not right. It's not the norm. So she's behaving abnormally. There are many people who pack their bags. There are many people who wait for the people who have passed on to come and collect them in different ways, emotionally in different ways. Mum is old. She's 90 years old. I think a good medical checkup in terms of her emotional state, her physical state needs to be done as well. And given this added trauma of severe and very deep loss and the way that has affected both her mental and brain function, you notice I make a difference there, a mental and yet a brain function, physical brain matter, needs to be looked at too. So consider that kind of specialist to have mum consult with. That's one. Two, we need someone to understand the need for her to be with her husband. The kind of physical need she needs to be with, why she needs to be with her husband physically now in time and space. The emotions behind this need to be together. So it's not just I am with you in one place together holding hands, but what is my emotional need and her emotional need? Can that need be replaced? Never. Can never be replaced. But how can that need be complemented or supplemented? How can a different need be met so that this becomes more relevant and put into perspective? This kind of counseling is crucial, not just for mum, but perhaps more importantly, for the primary caregivers first, to understand how and why people miss people in different ways. Don't forget the cultural background too, the amount of dependency, the amount of insecurity that mum might be feeling given her loss. Without him now, I'm lost and I can't survive this place now because of my inadequacies or perceived inadequacies. And maybe she needs empowerment there. Is she able to? Is she suffering in different ways? There are more questions than answers to this. The positive responses are, number one positive response is, thank you for the question. I'm so glad you're aware of this question. But make sure that mum is safe at any time. If she suddenly feels an impulse to want to be with her husband, she might leave the home accidentally without even knowing that she has left the home because it's so emotionally driven. So that safety is an important thing to look at. Try and be sensitive enough to her emotional state of helplessness, saying, I can't do anything anymore, and therefore there are other aspects that I want to consider. Be careful about things like that too. So understanding the grieving process, it's not just that mum is not resolved, mum is in denial. Hey, be careful about the single words that actually mean far more than just the word itself. Understand the process, understand mum's loss. And here, your experts, like people who have dealt with death, palliative care experts, they will be able to help you and they'll be glad to advise you. And they've had so many cases, like the case you've referred to, where people have felt the loss in different ways. And it is subject and case specific. No one size fits all. So keep an open mind. And I'm in a very odd way, I have a more positive response to this question, because mum is sensitive, mum is still emotional, mum is still in love, mum misses somebody, you are so responsive. There's so many positives about this situation, and I think the only way you're going to, I can only see you moving forward from this. It's really good.
Okay. And now we have Sean, who's messaged in. Sean is 30 years old and he suffers from extreme fear of heights, I think. He says standing on a condo balcony makes him sweat profusely, cold sweats. And he has a fear of falling off high escalators, such as those that you see in malls. And he'd like to know how he can deal with this.
Okay. First thing, don't let anyone belittle your fear. It's a definite fear. And if you give me examples of physiological symptoms such as cold sweats, maybe even increased heart rate, and in some cases you might start blurring and feeling faint, these are dangerous because it could affect where you are, who you are, and your health. But the fact is, the one comment that immediately, if you say you're sweating, means your body's involved. And so what I'm going to say very categorically is that panic situations and your physiology is now marrying with your thoughts, your intrusive thoughts of this fear of heights. Anyone should be afraid of heights. Everyone should be afraid of heights. It's not our normal situation as a human being to be
it's
in.
It's a defense.
It's a defense. It's a, yes. Your body wants to survive.
Survival instinct.
However, your body and your mind is filled with other thoughts, other negative intrusive thoughts that are associated with heights that's giving you this fear response. It's natural. It is okay to have any kind of fear. Now you need to understand it. There are many ways of dealing with this. You do not necessarily need medical intervention. Medical intervention will definitely stop your physical responses and maybe stop your sweating or lower your heart rate. It's not going to take away your cognitive or the way you process your fear. That's not going to change. You will need some kind of intervention or therapeutic assistance to help understand where this fear is coming from and how it's affecting you and how you can deal with it. So in this instance, you will need someone trained in mental health who helps you overcome this basic word called phobias. You are having a phobia, and there'll be a technical term for height phobia. I've forgotten what it is. It's some Greek or Latin, something. But basically, don't use labels. It should be as functional as possible. And I like the way you described your problem. Escalators, balconies. I'm afraid of this kind of things in these situations, in these moods. So one of the things I would help you with is to specify your problem and then investigate each aspect of the problem in terms of its functionality and the kind of dysfunctionality it presents itself with. The kind of people to help you with this are mental health experts, such as people who are trained in the area, clinical psychologists and psychiatrists. But like I said, you don't necessarily need medication. But in severe cases of phobias, a marriage of both has been prescribed as to be the best intervention. So we deal with both your bodily response and your emotional response as well. Mm. So, Sean, thanks for calling. And it's important that you deal with this. Let me say this. It is not uncommon. I'm not belittling your problem. And it is, you'll be surprised at how quickly a person like you can actually work with this problem. Mm. And someone that you can work with will really help you do that.
Mm. Oh, another question on WhatsApp. Are personality tests counterproductive? And you've talked about that a little bit, the psychometric test. And this person says, because these tests give some sort of confirmation bias to individuals with troubled minds.
Yeah. It's not just confirmation bias, but it also sometimes, worse still, opens the Pandora's box. You know, you don't need to know anything too much about yourself either. You know, go through self-discovery.
Is it really the right information?
Is it necessary to
right
have
answers?
Is it necessary to walk through an X-ray machine every day? You know, I want to see what's happening to my gut every day. I can tell you what's happening in the gut. Good stuff is going into waste stuff. You know, but the important thing here is why do you need a test? How relevant the personality test is? The kind of personality test? Who administers the tests? And if you ask psychometric. If you ask clinical psychologists and people who specialize in this area, they will talk about the validity of these tests, what it measures, how it measures, and to what extent it measures it to, whether it's valid, whether it's stable, whether it's reliable. So be very careful about these personality tests. I tell you what, you'll be surprised at how many personality tests I use. Very few. Mm-hmm. Very few, because it's not always necessary. Mm. Unfortunately, given the kind of commercial world we live in, people rely on things that they can see, such as numbers and graphs. And the only way you're going to plot this is with dots and with responses to questions. And so we have many tests which suggest high reliability and validity, but very specifically for certain kinds of function. So my response to you is be very careful with personality tests. Yes, I use them. I use them even when I make court responses and I give evidence. But I always remind the people who make decisions that the interview, the clinical interview, the discussion of the points, which you hardly see in a report, the issue of the existence and the function of the person between the lines of of your existence and what you do. That's more important.
Mm.
Far more important in terms of consistency and functionality during the day. So be very wary.
Very. Another question, just very quickly, we're running out of time, but Sterling is asking, how does one deal with the feeling of not being good enough?
Standards. Standards.
Expectations.
Expectations and perceptions of other people. How does one deal with that? Let me quickly draw you the axis. There's the zero factor axis, the normal line, okay? Then you go into a negative spiral downwards, and then you go into a positive spiral upwards.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a quick answer, the best thing for you to do immediately is to feel something positive about yourself. One thing positive about yourself, and say, let me build on that. Now, another thing you can do is talk to people who are relevant in your life to identify some of your strengths and some of your positive characteristics, and then build on that. So whatever you do, don't build on a brick with a crack in it.
Mm.
Find a brick in your system that looks like, sounds like, and people believe, and you believe, is a solid brick. Build on that. And once you start building on that one brick, you've moved yourself up into this positive spiral. Strength builds on strength. You'll be able to deal with your deficiencies and weaknesses later. But a quick response to your question, Sterling, is find one strength and build on that first. One strength, and you must agree with it.
Thank you very much, Paul. I'm so sorry. We've run out of time. That was Paul Jambunathan, consultant clinical psychologist, here for his monthly mental health clinic. He'll be back again next month. He's here on the first Wednesday of every month at 4 o'clock right here on Health and Living. So do tune in then to catch him again.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, this has been Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to BFM.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.